It seems I need to apologize for overloading people last time. Because last time we did both some Aristotle and some Sheldrake, because they're closely related, and I think we could think in terms of Aristotelian and non-Aristotelian theories. And that's not an original idea. In the 20th century, in the 60s and 70s, there was quite a strong recognition in academics of the difference between Aristotelian and non-Aristotelian theory. So I'm not going to burden you with all of that, but it's a fact, and we can see some signs of that in what we're looking at right now. We can distinguish, and I would like for us to learn to distinguish. And this is an excellent opportunity to do that. So the combination of Sheldrake and Aristotle last time, and also the time before and tonight, has a purpose. It's not that either one of those thinkers, one 2,400 years ago and one alive and well today, are in themselves necessary for us to know thoroughly. But that line of thinking, which goes from Aristotle to the Middle Ages, this is just the warm-up, you didn't miss anything. That line of thinking, which became very strongly revitalized in the 15th and 16th, 14th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th century in Europe, what provided the foundation for scientific thinking. So scientific thinking is what we have now when we speak about the theories of Darwin and neo-Darwinians, Dennett and Dawkins and the Genome Project and genetic manipulation and the possible future of humanity based upon science. That's all Aristotelian. And we could see last time the fundamental distinction that Aristotle made between mind and the life-body complex. Do you remember from last time that mind is something which he said is not influenced by heat and by physical phenomena? Mind is capable of knowing what is. Mind grasps the essence of things because it is of the same nature as the essence of things. So the essence of things is their form, that says Aristotle. And the form is the soul. The form of something is what it becomes in its full development. And that is the physical, the vital, and the mental aspect of the thing, when it's fully what it is. And then what we know is not the molecular level, and it's not the organic level, and it's not the intricacies of the belief system that we know. We know the person. You are you. I know you. You know me. We perceive that the form of that person and the form of that animal and the form of that ecosystem. And we think that we grasp it, what it is. But so Aristotle says that mind is able to extract the species, he called it, the essence. And then he asked the question, how does that happen? So that started the whole thing. If mind can know what is, if mind can extract the essence of things through perception and through its magical extraction of the species, if that essential nature is able to imprint itself on mind, because mind is of the same substance as the essence of something, its soul, its meaning, its that, you know, that all those holons that build up into that society or that musical system or that species of insect or whatever, all those layers that come to be what that thing is, can be known by us, because what made that be what it is its essence, its form, its soul. And soul somehow can be separated. It is separable by mind. It somehow, when mind knows the soul of something, it knows that. It's not just an impression that it makes on mind, as we believe in psychology. It's the thing itself that is known by mind. And before mind knows something, it's totally impassive, totally neutral. It's a blank slate. And then it comes into contact with, through perception, with an entity. And that entity doesn't enter into the mind. Mind knows that entity. It is a picture of Sri Aurobindo on the screen. And it's not that I have an image in my head of that picture or anything else. My mind knows that thing. So mind is somehow able, according to Aristotle, to extract from something its essence. So if it was Sri Aurobindo sitting there himself, radiating supramental force, we would experience that physically, vitally, mentally, and we would also know it. So the pre-Aristotelian thinkers had this phrase, can't remember exactly what it is, but it's a Parmenides had this phrase that Heidegger quotes all the time, knowing is being. Noein hogar estin. That which is known is what is. Being and knowing are the same. Auto is a word in there, same. So, knowing, auto, hogar, estin. What is known is the same as what is. So this is an ancient Greek notion. And we don't believe that at all, normally. We believe that we really can't know anything, truthfully. And everything that we know is interpreted and mediated. So we have spoken about mediated understanding, which is normally what we think the mind does. It first makes concepts, and it knows things as a result of putting together a lot of concepts. So according to our constructivist theory, we know that that's a photograph of Sri Aurobindo because we know what photographs are. We know that they can be projected on screens. We know we're familiar with the photograph of this person named Sri Aurobindo. And as a result of all of these exposures in our lives, we come to have a concept of the photograph of Sri Aurobindo, and that it's not Sri Aurobindo, it's just a photograph of him, and so on and on and on. And we forget that actually what's happening here is that mind is knowing what that is. So, from this Aristotelian early Greek philosophy of knowledge and the nature of mind, there are a lot of processes of thought and perception that we have that have grown out of that, that are the result of that. And one of the reasons why is because in the Middle Ages, Aristotle was rediscovered by the Catholic Church, and all the universities were taking place in cathedrals in Europe, and knowledge was rediscovered through the eyes of Aristotle by the Catholic Church.
Didn't the Muslims also have much to do with that?
Well, they found the texts and they translated them before they came to Europe. But all they really did was provide the texts and their commentaries. And then the Catholic scholars retranslated, because they knew Greek very well and they could refer to the Muslim translations and so on. But basically it was just a kind of postal service that the Muslims provided. But anyway, so much of our thinking is determined by Aristotelian concepts, and all the procedures of science, Demokratos and Biologos. These are fundamental Greek concepts.
Does it ever come into the Orient, even through history, through modern times, China and Japan, now in the 20th century, I'm sure they are involved in science and technology, but this influence of Aristotle didn't get into the other Oriental civilizations?
Not so directly. Through the church, first of all, and then through science.
To becoming modern.
By becoming modern, yeah. But mostly that was after the 16th century. But for Western society, it started in the 12th, and it was going strong throughout the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th. And so when we read a philosopher like Kant or Locke or Hegel, if you look deeply into what they're saying, they're often just paraphrasing Aristotle. Or they're paraphrasing Anselm or Aquinas, who commented on Aristotle. So it's our culture is deeply Aristotelian. So this idea that mind is not life, that the soul has three parts. It has the mind, it has the life force, and it has perception in the middle. Living things are characterized by vital activities, growth and nutrition and reproduction, perception, the senses, and mind. There are three souls, or three levels of soul in all living things. Plants are primarily of the nutritive sort. Animals are primarily nutritive and perceptive. And human beings are primarily a combination of nutritive, perceptive, and ideative, intellectual, intellective. And the soul, the soul which is the cause of all of that, is the entelechy, that which is the whole purpose of the thing. And that whole purpose of the thing includes the nutritive function, the perceptions that enable the thing to do what it does, and the behavior of the thing and its interactions. So we've been focusing for quite a long time here on behavior and how behavior is an evolutionary function. The way things behave in relation to the environment is a very major aspect of evolution. And genetic, the passing on of genes through reproduction only happens as a result of the successful behavioral interaction between the organism and the environment. If that's working, then the genes get passed on. If it's not working, then they don't get passed on. So the phenotype is largely responsible for the genotype. Is that understood when I say that? Do you know what I'm saying?
I was still thinking also when you said about the soul picture, that that's the cause of everything. Then how did it happen in the philosophy that remains somehow, but in the science it totally was annulled, inexistent?
Well, that's a very good question. And Sheldrake's theory is a very good example, and so is Darwin's theory of what happened. The question was raised by Aristotle and has been raised ever since. How? If mind is the final cause of everything, but mind itself is impassive, it is that unmoved mover. It somehow is the being of the thing which attracts it into its full nature and compels it into its full nature. But how does it do it? And so science becomes totally preoccupied with focusing this mind on the physics of things and the biology of things and the behavior of things to try to find out how this final cause works through the other causes, and Aristotle identified four: the material cause, the efficient cause. Those are the ones we're normally concerned with: the matter, the nature of the matter itself, and the efficient cause is what moves the matter, and the final cause, which is the total soul nature of the thing, and the form. You know, actually the form goes before the final cause. So, according to Aristotle, these are all causes: the material, the efficient outside force, the form, and the ultimate mind being in the universe, which is the permanent cause of everything. So they were very interested, the Greeks, in finding out about the cause of everything. And all the way up to Hegel, this is the big question: what is the reason for anything to be the way it is? And it's pretty much boiled down by everybody to some kind of quantifiable, observable, empirically observable and quantifiable efficient cause. So when we think about evolution as a result of Darwinian thought, it's about what we think about is the efficient causes like the environment and adaptation and availability of food and survival and so on, in the context of the constraints of the material atoms and chemicals and organs and so on. We don't think anymore very much about formal and final causes. So what we can see in Sheldrake is, as he says, that this idea of the ultimate final cause of things, the soul of things, determining everything, gets co-opted by biology and physics. And there are those who start to try to pin down the life force. And there are those like Sheldrake who try to pin down some theory of resonance, morphogenesis, to explain what? To explain learning behavior, to explain the phenomenon of habit. And all the biologists observe that habit is very much responsible for what everything is and what everything does. So learning and habit and adaptation, these are all the phenomena that are observed by biologists. Why is it necessary to have another theory of morphogenesis, that's formative causation, which predicates that when in evolution, when the from the embryo to the full-grown organism, the genes and molecules and organs start to form, the direction in which they form is determined by the direction in which they have previously formed. And so, because species at every level have forms which are the result of adaptation and whatever, genetic division and once those processes start, they constitute forms. And the more they happen, the more that form gets established as a pattern or a habit. And so in that view, the whole process of evolution has been constrained not only by matter and environment, and purpose and adaptation, it has also been constrained by morphic resonance. And morphic resonance is supposed to explain how one species' behavior gets transferred to another species, providing continuity between in the process of speciation. And so as I said last time, The theory of morphogenesis is based upon patterns of resonance that are hypothecated. It's a hypothesis of Sheldrake to explain what's already observable. Memory is there in matter and in life. How? Well, Sheldrake says, by morphic resonance. So he's adding a theory to explain a theory of behavior. And he says that it's very, very much based upon the laws of physics. The whole theory of morphic resonance is very much based on the law of physics. So this, his theory goes back to the theory of a person named Waddington. And Waddington has this, here's a design that you might see. It's just, it looks like waves and troughs. Waves and troughs. And at the top of the trough is a ball. So when that ball starts to roll, it's going to tend to go into those troughs, right? So when the embryo is developing, there's this force of development which is going to tend to go in directions, pathways, that have already been taken by that, by members of that species previously. And if you go back to the previous species from which that species diversified, there is a retention of many of those troughs, but there are new troughs that came into being. These are conventionally known as creodes, developmental pathways. And then they ask the question, why? Why developmental pathways? Well, because of morphic resonance. Because once those pathways get established, then they are maintained in a subtle, invisible, non-spatio-temporal world where all the forms are collected forever. And that is somehow supposed to explain learning and habit and memory. So, most of the biological, progressive biological theories of evolution today are heavily determined by physics. And this one is heavily determined by physics. And so, the whole question of evolution is very much a preoccupation of physics these days, and chemistry, of course, but and biology, but heavily determined by physics. So Ilya Prigozhin has this theory, which is quite a good theory, commonly accepted, that the way species maintain themselves is through the dissipation of energy. There are energy fields that we are, and we consume energy, and that energy dissipating through us enables us to maintain ourselves consistently as who we are and what we are and how we are. So the dissipation of energy is a factor of life. That's a physical theory. And it supports learning. Learning is another phenomenon that is manifested by all species. So dissipation of energy in itself doesn't explain life. There's also learning behavior which is going on. Insight behavior among lower animal species. Cognitive behavior. Cognitive behavior, perception is going on in single-celled organisms. So then biophysicists add another dimension to the dissipation of energy called cognition, mind. It's going on at the lowest level. And in between dissipation of energy and mind, there is autopoiesis, self-reproduction. The species is constantly reproducing itself, not only through cell division and sexual reproduction, but cells are constantly reproducing themselves in the body. So this, we are making ourselves all the time. Autopoiesis, making ourselves. So we have this theory, which is widely accepted in biology today, of a combination of these levels that are integrated, cognitive, autopoietic and dissipative, to define the process of life. But that doesn't define the process of evolution. How does variation take place, and adaptation and speciation? You know, so we looked at this book of Yablanka about how there's genetic variation is going on, epigenetic variation is going on through chemical processes, behavioral variation is going on through cooperation among members of species and the environment, and symbolic variation is going on, especially in human beings, but also in whales and elephants and some other, you know, bees, and there is some symbolic processes going on at lower levels, but primarily in through language and human beings. So the big question which remains is for Sheldrake and for Darwinists and for everyone is, what determines how the thing is which isn't yet existing, the new thing? And the new patterns have been emerging forever. Some of them have taken billions of years, and some of them take only a generation. But new patterns emerge in life. And they're better, often better adapted and more successful than the previous patterns of life. So where does that cause come from? And that's very similar to the question, where does the first cause come from? Especially for something like morphogenesis. You know, if everything is dependent upon forms that are already resonant with other forms, then where does the first form come from? And then where does the new form come from that's a major variation on the existing forms? So that we ended with that question last time, if you remember. You know, what's the big question that's left after we acknowledge that consciousness is evolving? It is there in matter, as evidenced by perception at every level of life. Mind is there in matter. Life is there in matter. It's the strongest force. And life and mind and matter have different principles that govern their behavior. So they're all there. We know that. Everyone knows that now. Sri Aurobindo predicted that would be recognized by science in 1920. And now you can't read a single book about evolution which doesn't recognize that all three principles are active at every level throughout history in the field of life, evolutionary life. Is that enough to know? Does that explain everything? Do we need to know anything else in order to understand evolution? Before we try to answer that question, I can see that didn't really turn anybody on. So, I wanted to give an example, another example of.
How? My question would be then: is this question, how can they take it? Like, why the text at the beginning was the word? I mean, the consciousness. How they take the science and the thing?
Well. Actually, there's a very easy answer to that question. It's called the Logos. The word is the Logos. It's a Greek word. And the word is Logos. In arche kai ho Logos. So all that it means is that creation is intelligent. So it's very easy for a physicist to say, this world, this evolving universe, is intelligent. And Sheldrake begins his book with something that I'm going to go into next time. He begins his book with a theory called the anthropic principle. And we're not going to go into that tonight, but in the middle of Dawkins' most recent book, there's a chapter on the anthropic principle. In Davies, you may know about Davies, the scientist Davies, who wrote the book God and the New Physics and Superforce, and lots of he's a real hard-nosed physicist who admits that there must be more going on in the universe than what we can empirically evaluate. So his most recent book is about the anthropic principle. And the anthropic principle is related to the Logos. Basically, it says simply that the universe has existed long enough, and the force fields, the four known force fields, have existed in the relationship that they exist in, according to universal constants, mathematical constants, such that carbon-based life had to emerge on Earth during the last 3 billion years, and is knowable by mind at this time, because that's the way the universe is made. The anthropic principle, anthropos is human intelligence. So the whole evolution of the universe isn't caused by the necessity of consciousness evolving in the human being, but is in itself composed in such a way that time and space and all the mathematical constants that are known are necessary for the emergence of the human being at this time. So this is the way that physicists now are looking at the Logos. And it doesn't imply any deity or any divinity or anything else. It's just the mathematical constants of the universe themselves are necessary for the emergence of mind. Therefore, mind is inherent in time and space. So this is a very popular way of thinking these days, and there's one fantastic book, which I'll bring next time and go through a little bit, called The Cosmological Anthropic Principle. And it was published in the 90s by a couple of physicists, and it's very, very hard-nosed mathematical physics. But there are a few chapters that are written for the biologist and for the layman, and so we can get to know a little bit about that theory. It's a widely recognized theory today, only in the last 10 years. And Sheldrake points out in this book, The Presence of the Past, which is available in bookstores in Pondi, that it's only been since the 60s that, and especially in the 80s, that physicists and cosmologists have known for sure that the universe itself is evolving. When Einstein was around, that wasn't known. And Einstein believed that the cosmos was invariable. So evolution is a fundamental principle of existence in the understanding of science today. And so one of the questions that we asked in the very first session, in the very first class, in the first series of sessions last year, was how does our understanding of nature and of the principle of evolution give meaning, value, enhance the value of our existence? Can we base a philosophy of existence, including our value system, what we live for, what's meaningful to us, on this understanding of nature? And Whitehead says that evolution, the theory of evolution, has been so predominant for the last 150 years, that it necessarily constitutes a very integral part of our beliefs and our values, and understanding it helps us to live our lives. So this was a question for the philosophy of evolution. In what way does knowledge of evolution influence our values and the way we live our lives? And if it does at all, then that's a very important part of a philosophy of evolution. Not just the science of evolution, but the philosophy of evolution. It's central to some people's lives and the way they understand existence. And it may be even essential to the survival of the species. So if so, then Whitehead's theory is totally correct. And that's why we're doing this course, because we think that it may be important for us to understand thoroughly the philosophy of evolution if it results in helping us become evolutionary beings. Otherwise, it's just an academic exercise. So, the hoax gene, I want to go back to something which I talked about in the first series, in the early part of the first series last year. Here's something well known by biology, which, like the behavioral theories of Lorenz, the behavior of chickens and ducks and so on, like his theories, these theories are very well known and very self-explanatory. This is on a very fundamental genetic molecular level. The determination of body plan, whether it's a starfish or an octopus or an insect or a four-legged animal, in the process of the embryonic development, the body plan of any particular organism who is a member of any particular species, and you know there are only about 5 body plans in existence, so this is something very finite, like the mathematical constants in the universe. There are only a handful of them. So there are only a handful of body plans. The determination of body plan from the single cell, single reproductive cell, and the construction of specialized organs, such as the eye, are under the control of regulatory genes. Most notable among these are the Hox genes, which produce proteins that bind with other genes and thus determine their expression at exactly the right moment, so that the unfolding of the organic complex at a certain moment in the development of the embryo is not a stomach, it's an arm. Or, you know, it's so each of the organs determined genetically is timed and triggered by the Hox gene in every species. So this Hox gene complex has been evolving since the origin of life. It is a fundamental mechanism of the development of every creature in every species throughout time. So those Hox genes in us have been there 3 billion years, and they have gradually complexified so that the human being has 38 Hox genes in each cell.
How do you spell Hox?
H-O-X. And primates have 38 Hox genes, and simpler organisms may have 3 or 6 or 10 or 15 or whatever, but the Hox genes are always there, and they perform that function. Now, my question or my observation is that since Hox genes are known to perform that function, and since they have been doing it ever since the beginning of life, and they do it the way it needs to be done almost every time. Sometimes there are mutations and there's a stillborn because the heart's not there or something. But for the most part, evolution has been greatly aided by this genetic function called the Hox gene. It obviously contains in it some kind of memory of what it is supposed to do when it's exposed to the chemical environment that helps it, you know, the epigenetic chemical stimulus, temperature and everything has to be just right for it to trigger a shift from the eye development to the reproductive organ development in the right sequence in the unfolding of the organism. So it knows when to trigger each of those things. It's part of its function. It's in its matter. Why does there need to be a morphogenetic, in other words, formative cause in addition to that material organic process itself? How does it help us to know the physics of attractors? You know, this idea of Waddington, it goes on to say that the morphogenetic fields are complexes of organizing factors which cause the originally indefinite course of the individual parts of the germ to become definite and specific. Formative fields cause the previously indefinite genetic material to become what it becomes. A self-organizing principle, which is not in the gene, it's in the morphic field of the gene. Okay, so let's just listen to this for a minute. They cause the originally indefinite course of the individual parts of the germ to become definite and specific, and furthermore cause this to occur in compliance with a typical pattern. And Waddington's concept of creodes canalizing development towards particular goals strongly resembles the pulling or attracting of pathways of development towards ends given by the entelechy, the form. The mind wants to explain how this Hox gene enables the organism to develop systematically in the embryo. Aristotle tried with the idea of soul. It's the It's the form of the thing itself which is attracting and compelling all the levels of the organism up until the time that the organism is a full-grown, mature thing. There is this subtle cause, final cause, which is the soul of the thing itself. So now, instead of the soul of the thing itself being the cause of all of that, or instead of the Hox gene being the organic cause of all of that, there is this physicist's idea that there are troughs and attractors and basins of morphogenetic fields that attract and push and compel the organic process into its pathways.
Stopping and resting and then commencing again and then stopping and commencing.
Well, I think this is an intensely fascinating idea, though, because something is compelling these organic systems into their pathways, and they are following those pathways out of habit which has been reproduced an infinite number of times in the species. So it's going on. This is what we know for sure. Development is going on. And then, so how is it going on? This is the thing that science is trying to explain with all of these theories, from the Hox gene to the morphogenetic field, to the soul theory of Aristotle, and to innumerable other theories, to try to understand how what happens happens. We know what happens.
Can you ask a question? If you have all this information in us, somebody loses an arm. Why this cannot be produced by itself? Why it doesn't work? There are some animals, they work, but why we can't do it? This is just coming up the question. If all this information is not there from the beginning, it will up us as we are seeing. It's all armor, all everything.
Who says that all of that information is there from the beginning?
How can we grow as a in the matter? How can we grow if the information is not there?
Oh, good question. How can we grow into supramental beings if the information is not already in the cells? Yeah. So you might recall that we had one session dealing with the metaphysical theory of Locke, who said that something cannot come from nothing, and intelligent life definitely must therefore come from cogitative nature, you know. And then Sri Aurobindo has a parallel passage which I put up on the board and read, where, and I can do that now too, it's on the computer here, where Sri Aurobindo says consciousness couldn't come from nothing, it couldn't come from matter, it has to have always been there.
Okay.
But does that imply that the information is there from the beginning?
The structure is there, but the information may not be there to have the structure do what it's supposed to do at a certain point.
Why can't it just be the drive of nature itself that acquires the information through evolution? And it only remembers as much as it has got up till now. But as much as it's got up till now is enough for it to know that it doesn't know enough to solve all of its problems. And so there's a pressure to go beyond the limits of this evolved mental vital structure. So there's a drive to evolve beyond where we are now. Why couldn't that have always been there at every level of speciation? So the combination between the drive, the life force itself, and the information that is being acquired every second by every cell and organ and organism, the combination of the drive and the learning process, the consciousness, the cognition, why isn't that enough itself to determine the leap? Why should there be already a final cause other than the drive itself? The drive itself, the life force, can be infinite and eternal, and space-time world is temporal and finite, and the combination of that unlimited force and the limitation of the cosmos, that combination might be enough by itself for evolution to go through all of its pathways. Become a hippo, yeah.
Yes. Why are human beings so slow to change? We've been in this shape.
Because we have hippo nature in us.
Okay. We're not slow. So that's one question, because we seem to be stuck in this.
Inertia holds us back. Yeah.
And would it not, I mean, from what I'm understanding of what you're saying, I'm assuming that this hot gene is constantly mutating in order to adjust to everything that's being thrown at it.
It's not constantly mutating at all. It's extremely stable.
It's just regulating everything.
It's regulating everything according to what it already knows.
But things are constantly changing.
Well, not at that level. We're talking, the Hox gene is working in the embryo. Once the embryo is developed, it doesn't work much anymore. Because what it determines is the body plan. Where the heart is, where the stomach is, where the eyes are. And so what biologists have been able to do is move the Hox gene around in a Drosophila and trigger the development of eyes on the legs.
Legs are the
antenna. But it's not going to do that by itself. It's going to put the eyes where they belong. But the biologists can manipulate that and get the eyes to come out somewhere else.
Well, what about the parent of this Drosophila who ingests opium, for example? I mean, you know, whatever it is we do when we're gestating. I mean,
yeah, so that's the epigenetic level, this chemical ingestion, which does influence patterns of development. But not those ones that we're now talking about that the Hox gene does. You know, unless the mother takes LSD or something during the development, and it can interfere with the triggering of genes. And so I've known people in San Francisco in the 60s who had babies with no arms and two heads and whatever because they were taking LSD all the time. Yeah, that's a fact. I've seen it myself. So it's not good to take LSD within about six months of, or 3 months of your fertilization process.
So what is changing? So our form isn't changing. Something must be changing.
Okay, but think back to a few weeks ago when we were covering the idea that evolution is going on in four dimensions all the time. Symbolic, behavioral, epigenetic, and genetic. So many of our changes take place because of our behavior. So if you meditate for 20 years, you're going to have a slightly different metabolic rate and brainwave rate than somebody who just goes to the bar every day and watches football. So this, and the potential is there in both people to undertake supramental evolution. It's already there in the genome. The phenome, the phenotype, is what we observe, what we see, what we do, what we are. That's the phenotype. And there's a lot of evolution going on in the phenotype as a result of behavior and the ingestion of molecules. Does that answer your question? That those changes are not going on at the genetic level. Sri Aurobindo has made it pretty clear that the supramental evolution has to take place from the top down, not from the bottom up. So the human being is already ready to take leaps in evolution before there is the manifestation of a supramental being, which has completely different cells and organs and everything else. That he foresaw as being way down the road. First, there has to take place an evolution of supramental consciousness in the phenome of the human being before there's any question of genetic change.
Period of time needed for very large changes keeps becoming shorter and shorter. So man, as he presently is now, what, 50,000 years old, millions of years
right.
old?
Right. Well, no, our type of human being is 50,000, but that's Homo sapiens sapiens. But Homo has been there for over a million years. So, you know, our genetic branching away from primates is more like a million, 2 million, 2 million years. But there are several types of Homo hominids that have come up along the way. So we're sort of at the top of that line, from Australopithecus to Homo erectus to Homo sapiens and Neanderthalus and finally sapiens sapiens. But that's all one more or less continuous development, line of development. And so there's been a lot of genetic variation going on just within that million year range. And so that's fast compared to speciation. Other speciation that we know of has taken 50 million years. So the possibility of a supramental evolution, not just transformation of consciousness, but a genetically influenced supramental being, you know, in relation to history as we know it, that could take place within, say, a few thousand years instead of a million years. But first, there has to be the development of the supramentalized mental being. And that's Sri Aurobindo's project. Sri Aurobindo and the mother have manifested an energy which is supposed to help us transcend mental being. Now, Why is it necessary to do that? This is something that has been implied by the survey of Aristotelian thinking that we have been doing. The fact is that Aristotelian thinking is what we normally know of as mind, mental being. It's empirical, rational understanding, ethical behavior, everything about the mental being was known by Aristotle 2,000 years ago. And what scientists are doing with the theory of evolution is just a spin on that same mental being that's been developing, not evolving, developing for a few thousand years. And what we're learning, what Bergson tells us, this is the non-Aristotelian branch, what Bergson tells us, and many psychologists in the 20th century, and Sri Aurobindo, what they tell us is that it's possible to take another more intuitive track and to come to know things directly as themselves, not to have a mediated understanding of things, but to have an energetic identification with things themselves and to know differently than the mind knows. And in order for that to happen, yoga is very helpful because it teaches us to step back from our habits of mental thinking and our habits of vital interaction and behavior and even our physical dependencies, and to allow this intuitive force of consciousness to irradiate itself in us, through us, and bring to us knowledge by identity, intuitive, direct knowledge. So that would be a non-Aristotelian diversification of the human being on the basis of potentialities that already exist.
The human being is a developing mental creature. So I think I understand suddenly what that means. That's why we're being so slow, is we haven't gotten there yet. So we haven't reached our full potential, this thing.
Right.
But I'm going to ask you a question. I'm not trying to make a joke. I just want to understand. If I meditate in the cave for 20 years, 40 years, and I develop this great capacity, mm-hmm. that I haven't had time to reproduce in the process of doing this, how does...
Good question.
Okay, how does my habit get transferred?
Well, but you didn't acquire that habit through biological evolution. You acquired that habit through cultural development, through symbolic development.
Okay, so I can teach the guy in the next.
So you can pass that on. The mother said that this supramental change is going to take place by contagion, not by reproduction. Okay, that is something that we're dealing with in our Savitri class. I'd like to keep that question for Wednesday. Sorry, but that's exactly what Savitri is about, and it has nothing to do with this course, but it has everything to do with that course.
Yeah, because I thought when you come back, how do you adapt to the environment that is to them?
Yeah, so this is a mystical, spiritual question. It's not really relevant in this context. Yeah, you will, don't worry. That's what Savitri is all about. You know, once you engage fully in Savitri, you'll realize that that is exactly what Savitri is about. It's not about anything else. It's about death and rebirth. And so, on Wednesday night, we're going through the Book of Yoga. And that's the answer to that question. So,
It's interesting, I don't know if it has any relation to what you're talking about, but I'm talking to Buddhists who are talking this and that and the other thing there. The death and then karma, of course, based on, right? Death and the rebirth are a thought moment. There's no...
I don't know anything about that. I'm reading Sheldrake and Darwin. So we can stop here and take up what supermind is next time, if you like. There's a page which I'm ready to queue up which tells what supermind is. But we can do it next time, because I think we are ready to ask the question, finally.
We should read this chapter.
I would advise you to read the chapters if you haven't already. They are 6, 7, mainly 6 and 7, and in the yoga of self-perfection, in the last section, chapters 6 and 7, and if you reread those now, all of that stuff about citta and manas and buddhi is exactly all of it. He says everything that it's necessary to know to understand how the Hawks gene works. He says the citta has always been active in matter, and citta is memory. So you don't need to add to that morphic resonance. Memory is a fundamental principle of mind that has been active in matter since the beginning. To say that mind, life, and body are an integral complex in the universe is to answer the question how the Hawks gene knows to trigger the development of the shrew embryo, and to trigger the development of the hippo embryo, and to trigger the development of the human embryo, because that gene has been evolving from the beginning, and memory is inherent in it. It's inherent in organic substance. It's called citta.
So mind is involved.
It's involved from the beginning. So the question, how does it work? It works by the functions of mind, because that's what mind does. It remembers. And it wills according to stimuli from the environment.
Not tonight, but sometime. How do plants get involved? They are alive.
Well, absolutely, because citta is also there in the plant. It's there, according to Aristotle, and here's where, you know, the traditional knowledge, whether it's Greek or Indian, doesn't make any difference. Aristotle knew that all organisms know how to nutrify themselves and grow and develop and become parents and build habitats and all of that. That knowledge is part of the nutritive soul. Another way to say nutritive soul is citta. Another way to say perceptive soul is manas. Another way to say intellective soul is buddhi. So there's an absolute identity between Aristotle and the Indian system in that respect. There's a difference, though, when it comes to asking the question of cause. How does it work? Sri Aurobindo's answer and Bergson's answer and generally the mystical answer, the Buddhistic answer, is different from the Aristotelian answer. So that's what we have to become sensitive to. And we'll see that when we begin to say, what is supermind? We'll see how the non-Aristotelian and the Aristotelian differ. And it's very crucial to our understanding of evolution. It's absolutely crucial, because the Aristotelian way of thinking doesn't answer the question. How do things know what they know? Why are those habits which characterize the seeing of the bat, how do those habits happen to exist? Just through random mutation? Hardly. So each species maintains the habits that it does according to its nature. But what is that, the nature of an organism? What is sight? Is it the eye? Is it the nature of the eye? Sight is an organ of consciousness. Sight is an otherwise irreducible phenomenon. Sight is sight. And it can't be explained by the molecular structure of the eyeball. So how can it be explained? There is a non-Aristotelian explanation. Next time. I can give you a hint, if you want.
I want to ask a question, but give the hint.
Well, go ahead and ask the question.
No, give the hint, give the hint.
It's not knowable by mind.
I saw. I'm very interested in this contagious thing.
Have you been to the samadhi lately?
Yes. So I don't necessarily need to be regularly in silent concentration with people who have realized their psychic being, or do I need to do that in order for me to start for it to rub off?
Well, I would say that it's a continuum, and there is a time period when it is helpful, and then there is a time period when it's no longer particularly important. But, you know, that's just a kind of general observation. As for you personally, I have no idea.
So then there's also this spiral dynamics thing, that when a collective evolves and you're part of that group and you keep moving, it becomes an advantage to you to be in that group rather than the primitive tribe.
For a while. But then there's another point where it may be a disadvantage.
Then you go off in your individual evolution.
I mean, there's a very good reason why Sri Aurobindo stayed up there all the time.
You know? Well, that was true.
No, but he was exemplifying the extreme end of the yogic effort. So there's a collective level, and at the same time that there's that collective level, there is the individual effort that goes on, not just collectively, but individually. And then there's the more specialized association with those who are really beneficial to your individual development, And then eventually there are some things that have to be done just by the individual to make transitions. So Sri Aurobindo has covered all of that. It's not much of a mystery. And the Buddhists are very knowledgeable about that also. Tibetan Buddhists and Zen Buddhists and mysticism of all kinds. Another hint, Bergson, in his last book, and I would love for you all to be able to read the last chapter of his last book. If you show some interest, I'll get copies of it. But it's, he said that there's a mystical consciousness that is the essential driving force in evolution. And it manifests itself through social structures. But from time to time, an individual is able to tune in to that mystical source of conscious, creative evolution itself. And whenever that happens, it brings about a major shift in the nature of social structure itself. And that at this time, he said this in 1931, at this time of the development of science and Aristotelian thinking, what will make the most difference to the survival of the human being and the transcendence of the human being is the exceptional identification of one or more individuals with that original creative source itself.
So we have to define Shakti.
Jesus Christ.
Not in 1931. And when you read the last chapter of his last book, he speaks all about how a collective can form on the basis of that higher intuitive mystical consciousness, and what the principle of human unity is that will manifest in that collective. And it's just like you were reading a blueprint of the work of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And I pointed out before that in 1907 he published Creative Evolution, and that was 7 years before Sri Aurobindo started writing The Life Divine. And there he says that that consciousness eventually will overcome all the resistance of matter, including death.
I have a question. This context, before the First World War, there was a very high development of philosophy and advanced thinking. And brought back after the First World War, which completely lost a lot of precious ideas between 1850 and 1914, and then the thing completely...
Have you heard of Helen Caldicott? Dr. Helen Caldicott?
Yes.
I heard her in person say one time, when all the hostile resistance rises up, we know we're making some progress.
It's rising, it seems. Sarah Palin.
She's not a mystic at all.
but
she was sensitive enough to see that what was happening to her was happening because she had really broken through some barriers in the scientific community regarding nuclear power and all of that, and her movement was really gaining momentum, and then this establishment just pounded her, like, into oblivion. Does that make sense to you in that context?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, but I was thinking of more, let's say, a type of consciousness which falls back and is falling back. I never really understood how it is possible, because I see evolution as something going forward, and if you observe these things in the time between 1914 and 1918, what happened, and then the human mind got so much backward.
But is going forward horizontal or vertically?
It's a spiral.
And if it's a spiral that's going like this, then that movement is also carrying it in that direction. And so its evolution is both horizontal and vertical, and there's a constant wave pattern that's created by that.
I want to talk about the society level of practicing philosophical ideas in daily life. It was very much higher before the First World War.
Yeah, I agree.
Reached that level.
No, I agree completely.
But that's my feeling in many fields that I also observe. That it seems to be recovering now, actually.
Heidegger is a good example of that, where Heidegger was going like this, and along comes the Nazi Party, and goes like that, and then towards the end of his life he took off again. But his development was completely blocked by the Nazi thing. And at that, and Sri Aurobindo said around 1920, there are a few, maybe one or two, he said, there are some German thinkers who show signs of strong evolutionary advance. But the problem is German politics and social development is very turbulent at this time, so we don't know how far they will go. And it's amazing that Heidegger fits exactly in that profile. So he's speaking in the 20s about this non-Aristotelian knowing being and the radiance of being and all of that, and he doesn't resurface again until 55, you know, and from 1955 until 1975 he's on a completely new track, way above where he was even in the 20s. But in between, it was just a mess. You know, it was a mess in Germany, and it was a mess in Heidegger.
They made him act within the parties.
He was taken out of circulation after a short period of time, and it wasn't. So anyway, it's just a, you know, one lifetime, which is, was fairly, you know, short period in the whole history of consciousness, but you can see exactly what you're talking about and the impact that it had. And think about Sri Aurobindo and the mother. What Sri Aurobindo was saying in the 20s, socialism has the possibility of becoming an inspired, anarchic, revolutionary thing. And when he revises the ideal of human unity in 1940, he says, the potential of socialism was lost.
But this knowledge or this consciousness was only in very small pockets, like in Berlin, in Frankfurt, in Heidelberg, maybe in Zurich and in Vienna. And then there were only very few people together having this consciousness. And it had some impact on the society, and then as the society changed, the impact of...
Yeah, but those few people were not just in Frankfurt. They were also in Britain, and they were also in America. And, you know, there was really an incredible social possibility that existed prior to World War I that didn't exist after World War I.
Yeah, but
think you're absolutely right about that.
I've seen recently a movie about the British Empire before 1914, color movie, and I felt this impact as it was in Vienna or in Berlin or in few German-speaking places was not the same Paris and in London.
Yeah, well, maybe.
They have been all activated in the movement in Germany in the 17th and 18th.
Look, Bergson was French. And he had a huge impact at that time. He got the Nobel Prize. You know, people were listening to him. But after that time, nothing. So anyway.
Thanks for your attention.
It's your joy.